All right, Bon Appetit Foodcast, and I am Adam Rappaport. You know what? It's November 14th, which means we're like 1 week and 1 day away from Thanksgiving. So today, we've got all the turkey and mashed potatoes and stuffing that you can handle. First, we got Carla Music and Chris Morocco from the BA Test Kitchen to talk about our new favorite recipes from the latest issue of Bon Appetit. And then Chris and Carla will answer questions from you guys, our listeners, who emailed us in the past couple of weeks about all those sort of Thanksgiving essentials and how to master the big meal. But before we get started, I wanted to let you know that we'll be airing a bonus episode. Yes, a bonus episode this Friday with even more Thanksgiving content, because after all, it is the best food holiday of the year. So look out for that this Friday. And now let's do this. Here is Carla and Chris. Carla, welcome back to the pod.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
As always. And we got Chris Morocco here.
Hey, thank you.
Tag team. All right, guys. Here's what
Chris
we're going
to
do.
Not just Chris Morocco, but Chris Morocco with timer and pen.
I just wanted to seem ready.
Tucked into his apron that he's still wearing.
He's ready.
So big Thanksgiving episode. Here's what we're going to do. The first half of the episode is going to be us talking about new things to introduce to the Thanksgiving table this year.
Cool.
We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with listener questions, real listeners with real questions, kind of addressing the more nuts and bolts of the Thanksgiving meal. That work for you guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like football, right? With the two halves.
Oh, big time.
And the second half.
What's the halftime show?
Yeah. We got Maroon 5 this year.
Yeah.
Super Bowl.
Cool.
Great.
I can't even get into that. All right, so we got a Thanksgiving issue out on stands right now. A bunch of new stuff, as always. So I guess my question is, Carl, I'm going to throw this to you first, like a pass. I'm going to pass this to you.
Okay, cool. You're going to hut over
no,
to me?
No, I'm not gonna. No, I'm not gonna hut anything. Okay, so like at the Lolly household at Thanksgiving, what is like the policy in terms of introducing new dishes to the table each year compared to having to have certain dishes that always return? That is like the Tom Brady of your table that will always be there.
Okay, I don't know what that means except for Deflategate. But
hey, why do you have to go there? Why go there?
He's the greatest of all time. Come on, back off.
The point is, he's the GOAT and he's been around forever and he's 41 years old and he's still playing.
Okay, I don't care who you are, but if you want to bring something new to the Lollies, it's already too late. You needed to start lobbying in like early December of the previous year.
You have to sell them on it.
You're going to want to set a foundation. That was such a great meal. It was epic. It was the X. It was Y. It was Z. Next year, would we blah, blah, blah. And then maybe check in the spring, late summer.
Does this mean you and your sister or guests?
Oh, no, like, guests aren't allowed.
So they mean even like family members have to lobby Carol for inclusion?
That's who else is there. It's like all of us. And it's not, no, Carol's easy. Carol's like, loves new things, loves flavor, loves recipes, loves to try stuff. Frank is like
the OG. It's Frank?
Frank is he's like, but if we had that, does that mean that we wouldn't have the this? And it's like, what? Yes.
Are you
and
trying
he's
to
like,
say,
well, I don't know if I can have, no.
You're trying to say like Frank Lolly is like the Frank Sinatra of the house. He's just like, he does it his way.
His
way, get it?
Ooh,
and that's that.
He's just like, looks forward to certain things at certain meals. And if he doesn't get that, then it's like kind of shocking. However, a couple of dishes that I introduced when I hosted, I'm not hosting this year, but when I did host, I made Andy Baragani's smashed double cooked sweet potatoes with the tomb.
Yeah.
And very unexpectedly, they're spicy and they're bitter and they're charred and they have this like
punchy,
delicious,
garlicky.
Punchy. Yeah. Mm. And Frank loved them. He was like, we have to have these every year. These are fantastic. Yeah. I'm actually, without having talked to anybody, kind of on the side strategizing, just showing up with a second turkey.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Can't you just crash? Can't you just bring something?
She might not be invited back next year.
That's the risk, right?
So, all right. So we got a bunch of new dishes in this current issue. And so I want to, not being a test kitchen editor, not being the guy who's developing these things, I don't know how they're made. You know, I see them. Maybe I get a nibble. But I want to get some more insider information from you guys, because I am sort of, we are hosting this year at the Rapid Buck household. And, you know, I like to mix things up a little bit, not too much. So I'm just going to throw some out there and I want to hear from you guys. All right?
Absolutely.
Okay. First up, I'm very intrigued by the parsnip confit with pickled currants. A, because I think parsnips are totally underrated. B, I will eat anything that is confit.
Great. So parsnips are not even underrated. They're just like not
They're
rated.
Not even yeah. rated. I mean, they don't even make it.
They don't. People are like, what's a parsnip? A starchy carrot? What's the point?
You know what they are? Better than sweet potatoes.
Whoa.
Interesting.
Yeah. They're like a potato-carrot hybrid.
No.
They are a potato-carrot hybrid. Yeah. I agree with that. So this was, I will take some responsibility for inspiring this and then half
I think Carla, I think you were like, listen, there's going to be parsnip confit on the menu.
Yeah.
So let's get it together people.
So yes. So how do you do it?
So you take parsnips, which I've done, we did a deep dive on what makes a good parsnip and or not. And the answer is you just don't know until you get them. So just get all the ones. There's no picking. Yeah.
They're like thick, knobby, yellow carrots.
Yeah.
Kind
sometimes they're woody in the middle. Sometimes they're, that happens with the big ones, but it also is a storage thing. So just like, don't worry about it. Just get the parsnips, and we worked a thing into the recipe where you cut out the core if it's woody. Big deal. You get your parsnips, you peel them, you quarter them. If they seem like they have a woody core, you take that out, and then you cook them low and slow in olive oil. And
like fully submerged?
Fully submerged. And cool. You can do that. What I like about this is that you can do it very weeks. You could do it now. Do it today. And they become completely tender, but also, you know, because they are starchy, they're taking on this olive oil. So they've got this like real beautiful richness to them. And then you can get a really nice sear. So you take them out of their confit oil, and then they just need to get a little bit of color. And the garnish that Molly Boz
came
up with.
So you're browning them to finish them.
Just
They've
to finish.
Already cooked through, so you're just like kind of getting that nice sear.
Little sear.
Caramelization and whatnot.
Exactly, because they're filled with fat and they've got a lot of their own natural sweetness, so they're going to take on color really quickly.
But good, healthy fat.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
All of the, you know, they came out of the earth. Big deal.
Olive oil.
So, and then the condiment that Molly came up with after being tortured / tasked with this recipe is a really bright, acidic, currant, vinegary garnish that is just balances everything out, and it feels very seasonal to me too.
All right, I just realized this.
Are you gonna make them?
Well, yes, I'm gonna make them. But
you
B,
are?
Yes, but this is very similar to our favorite duck confit recipe.
Oh, yeah.
In Bon Appetit, where you finish them with like pickled,
that's right,
like
those
raisins.
Mustard.
Yeah, it's sort of like spicy similar. Raisins with that, because that vinegar and that sweetness helps cut through all the rich fattiness.
Totally.
And that you should also search for that recipe, for the duck confit recipe on Bon Appetit, which is phenomenal with pickled raisins or whatever they are. Yes. Okay, so I am very intrigued by that. I am definitely making that. This is something we kind of do. Chris, I'm going to throw this one to you maybe.
Yeah, sure.
Simone and I have riffed on this one, but sauteed or stir-fried Brussels sprouts, which is different than the typical whole or halved Brussels sprouts, which I think most people would do, correct?
Sure. I mean, I think this is the kind of dish that can convince, you know, a major Brussels sprout skeptic, you know, because when you separate the leaves, you're able to get this really quick kind of crunchy sear on
them. Let's talk about when you separate.
Well, the thing is, okay, so, you know, yeah, so a lot of people roast Brussels sprouts halves, because frankly, it's a lot less work. But if you take the root end off and then separate the leaves, you know, from that kind of central core.
And having done this, you are literally doing this by hand. And you can do it kind of quickly, but you're
what,
literally.
Like you're going to do it by machine?
No, but I'm saying.
By RoboCoo.
This is, yeah, people have a. This is
by
not
child.
Oh my gosh. I'm just saying, this is not like a Cuisinart sort of thing where you're making a slaw. You're literally separating each individual leaf, and you're pulling each sort of. What are the heads?
Yeah,
yeah,
the little you're literally tiny heads pulling, of cabbage,
pulling the heads apart.
And so then, after several minutes, and hopefully you have like your kid or someone helping, you have
for
a
sure.
big bowl of little petals, little Brussels petals.
Yeah, and then they just sear in a completely different way. They're in that leaf form. So, and also when you separate them into leaves, I mean, this could be whatever, maybe 12 heads of Brussels sprouts there. You know, like you get a lot of volume. You know, as long as you're not overcooking them,
yeah.
And they get that charred edge. And then these are finished so simply. We put a little touch of walnut oil, you know, or you could use olive or sesame oil for a little bit of that kind of toasty, nutty flavor. A little bit of lemon, and it's the simplest but one of the most satisfying kind of sides you could do.
This is this also a version of this has become a staple in our household, and Simone's big into it every year. And like I said, it's labor intensive at first, but then it cooks so quickly because it's like if you have a wok or something, perfect.
Yeah.
Really high heat, because you want it to stay kind of crispy and crisp.
You don't want them to steam. No, you want direct heat contact.
And that's what
happens
to most
Brussels
sprouts, or especially if you're going to like a pub in London, you get the Brussels sprouts and they're just kind of soggy
and they get
smelly.
That farty cabbagey thing.
That's
no
when they
offense.
Go gassy. That's why I didn't like Brussels sprouts my whole life, because they were boiled.
Anytime they steam or boil, anytime there's like that introduction of water, it's bad news.
You smell them before you see them.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. Yeah, so I think this is a cool modern, if you will.
Yeah, crunchy,
treatment.
Really fresh.
And this is kind of something
sweet.
That you guys do at home
we
too,
do this,
right?
And when it's time to do this dish, it's also one of those sides that you put in the work a few days ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to the football, just make sure there's some football. You could do this Monday night.
You're trying to say you're game planning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you're game prepping.
Game
because
prepping.
Because you're watching the game and you're coring and you're separating. And then those bags.
Are you the Bill Belichick of the Lally household?
I don't know. He's a little grumpy.
Yeah, Carla can get a little grumpy and bossy.
A little territorial around the test kitchen.
You think?
As
long as I have the headset, I'm good.
You get a headset. What I've learned from the BA kitchen over the years is you have whatever greens, or let's say in this case, your Brussels petals. I like to call them petals. Put those in a Ziploc bag and push all the air out and seal it. And it's like they're vacuum sealed.
Totally.
And they stay like super fresh.
They'll be great also because they are a cabbage. They're hearty. They're not going to wilt on you. And that's a Monday night thing that's done. And then in between, you know, when you're done with your cocktail hangout, nuts and whatever crab dip you're having. And then at my house, we bust out the two biggest cast iron skillets and two batches. And then that's one of the last things that goes on the buffet.
I feel like you can't have too much lemon juice at the end to really brighten it up. It's a great hit.
It never hurts.
Okay, I'm really intrigued. And as you can tell, we're starting with sides. Broccoli Caesar. That's one of those recipe names. I hear that and I'm like, ooh. Talk to me about the broccoli Caesar.
I love a raw side, and I feel like, you know, I know we're going to get into this later, but people are looking for make ahead kind of solutions, you know, to like what they can make ahead, what they can do ahead, you know, and like obviously Brussels sprouts, you know, like peeling and separating those leaves, absolutely. But a raw side, it's just so little prep involved. You're making a dressing and then you're taking raw broccoli, slicing it so that you can get all that kind of stem and all that kind of crispy, you know, kind of tender, like inner stem.
Question.
Yeah.
When you say slicing, are we like, do you need a mandolin or can you
hand? No, absolutely by hand. You just kind of want to carve off the tops of the florets, because if you kind of chop those two roughly, then you get those little bitty floret, pieces everywhere.
Yeah.
Not the end of the world, but you know, so if you just kind of carve off the tips of the florets of the flowers and then just working down the length of the stalk, you know, just slicing thinly, but by hand with a knife, you know, and peeling any bit of stalk where you get that hard, tough kind of broccoli, you know, dinosaur skin. You know,
I always like to peel my broccoli, the stem.
Center stem,
and then chop those into coins.
Absolutely, because it's delicious. I mean, broccoli stem could be its own
so
vegetable.
Overloved.
You know?
Yeah.
And then it's a classic Caesar dressing. I mean, the anchovies are optional, and I know, you know, they can be like kind of divisive at Thanksgiving. I mean, I think that was the one critique we had of it in the beginning. It was kind of like, you know, more than a couple anchovies, and all of a sudden it's like, wait, does this belong at Thanksgiving?
Right.
But a couple anchovies, no problem. Just gives you a little bit of that kind of umami.
I want anchovies mixing with my gravy, personally.
I think a good,
personally.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little particular about my anchovy sort of level, but I do think a good Caesar, the dressing should be like, ooh, that's delicious, as opposed to, ooh, that's anchovy. You know what I mean?
Yes. And the other thing, so this recipe in particular has already, because I get advanced, you know, exposure to these recipes, this broccoli Caesar has been in heavy rotation in the music household.
Oh, really?
And the children love it. And they don't know there's anchovies in it.
Carla gets to read the other team's playbook.
I feel like I need to get Marlon to do like a exchange program with Cosmo or something.
Where we trade kids.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
You need to break him like a Mustang.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you see another kid eating something, you might not know.
Yeah, so it's kind of a slaw that's then tossed in the dressing,
exactly.
And you do some shaved parm at the end. Is parmesan allowed at the Thanksgiving table?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Really?
Why not?
Absolutely.
We got soy sauce in the gravy this year. Everything is good.
But you don't know what's in there. It's just like, ooh, what's that?
But what is parm? I mean, it's salty.
Cheese from Italy. From the Parma
but
region of Italy.
Why wouldn't it be allowed on the table?
Because it's just so explicitly Italian, like Italy Italian.
I think you can tell a lot about a house and the family that is hosting by some of the traditions that make it to the table. Like also, that sauteed Brussels sprout leaves like is a thing that we always did. Italians love their cabbages and their cruciferous things. Mm-hmm. And like we didn't roast the Brussels. We sauteed them like escargot.
Mm-hmm. We didn't know what to do kind of growing up because my grandma was just like, it's Thanksgiving, aka it's a big meal. I'm going to serve you tortellini and brodo, a pork roast, a pasta dish, and then I'm going to give you Thanksgiving dinner as well.
I just feel like in America, the Italians get the other 364 days a year in our table, you know? It's like, I'm never not eating olive oil and Parmesan cheese. So maybe, whatever, that's just me.
I love the idea that there's just like a turkey because they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I need a drink. In the new issue, you have something called a fall spritz that apparently Molly Boz was obsessed with creating.
Yes, Molly Boz broke it down. Two ingredient. One of these cocktails that you're like, why hasn't I had this before?
Yeah.
I can has cheeseburger.
Why hasn't I had a Verna and nice dry cider?
Tart cider.
Yeah, so Molly, I'm reading a pull quote. This cocktail was inspired by my love of the spritz, which I think is a pretty popular thing among folks now. Speaking of the Italians again, which I'm always trying to steer into fall. Here, this Spanish cider is a dry, funky counterpart to the herbal Amaro. Amaro is also very popular these days, I would say, again with the Italians. And it makes for a drink that's easygoing enough to sip all day. So what I like about this is A, two ingredients. B, it's on ice.
Yep.
C, Molly's last point, like if you're like hitting like the Jack Daniels or the Kettle One at 2 p.m.
God bless you.
Yeah, like by 5 p.m. you're just done. Face down on the sofa.
There is always someone who will be asleep at the table and, you know, God bless them, but I don't want it to be me, you know? I like it's low alcohol. It's very refreshing. And you can also just tell people to go mix their own. There's like no big thing about go fix yourself a drink.
Go fix yourself? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Go fix. Okay. All right. This next dish, you're going to have to sell me on this one because I happened to come into the test kitchen the first day this dish was being tested and it was an unmitigated disaster.
The cornbread
stuffing, speaking of Molly Boz again, apparently got better, but day one was not pretty.
Allegedly, it got better.
Yeah.
It's good enough to run in the magazine.
It is.
So sell
it
me
is
on
totally
it.
Delicious. What was wrong with the one that you saw?
It was like dry and crumbly and there wasn't enough, it wasn't incorporated enough, you know, there was like the greens on the bottom and the bread on top and it didn't come together. Like a stuffing should be, you get one spoonful
slightly
and it's
like
all,
custardy.
And it's all there together.
Sure.
It's like ice cream, but it's like, you know, it's like a scoop. You should be able to have a scoop of stuffing. This was not that. So talk to me about the development process and what's going on with this stuffing.
She kind of had to work it from two directions, right? So first she had to develop a cornbread that had a really nice kind of pronounced corny flavor, but wasn't too sweet, you know, and was dry enough so that you could kind of slice it and have it not be kind of cakey and kind of dense, you know? So she had to kind of work the cornbread angle of it. And then she had to put that into a stuffing and dial in how much liquid, how much egg, how much broth. So I think you caught that kind of awkward, you know, kind of, you know, preteen year.
The task was fix everything that's wrong with cornbread stuffing.
Yeah.
And when that is the thing, when everyone wants to talk so much crap about cornbread stuffing and you have to just take it down to like, why does cornbread stuffing suck? Why is it mushy? Why is it too sweet? Why does it not absorb? Mm-hmm. And work through it. It was a real bottom-up experience. I think you maybe had it at the bottom.
Yeah. And that's also a little insight into how the test kitchen works is that things are tested again and again and again until they work. And in this case, I got that very first step. You're like, all right, let's try to make some homemade cornbread. And then this recipe calls for sausage and collard greens, of which
that
I like
helps.
Both. And there's like some creaminess going on there. So you have the cornbread, then you're sauteing the greens.
Mm-hmm.
And the sausage, yeah.
And the sausage, then you're mixing in heavy
sweating
cream.
Sweating in your aromatics and stuff. Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
The collards get kind of braised a little bit with that liquid, so they're totally tender before they go have their make-out sesh with the cornbread.
Jeez. Someone's had a few too many fall spritzes today.
The cream is really interesting in there because you don't see that in a lot of stuffings or dressings, whatever. And I think it is making up for a little bit of that kind of dry quality that cornbread is, you know, kind of prone to have. So it kind of it mitigates that and creates that richness you want.
But you can't just go buy cornbread and make great cornbread stuffing.
We've tried that so many years, you know, and not to name names, but we've gotten it from stores, major, you know, national chains, and it's always too sweet.
Yeah.
It's always too cakey.
Yep.
Yeah, it's more cake than bread.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. What's nice about in the issue, we have like a nice sort of step-by-step grid of all the different sort of steps involved in making the dressing, from the braising the greens, the adding the cream, the crispy sausage, all that sort of stuff, and sort of mixing it all together. And I think that's like the big step. And I think also just one, we've talked about this before, but with stuffing, it's like always add a little bit more liquid than you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was talking to my buddy Joe House on his podcast recently, and I was saying I've had over the years lots of dry stuffings. I've never had a too moist stuffing. Like right. That has not happened.
Yeah, right. Too moist would probably just mean it's like you almost have like a layer of like omelet, you know, kind of pooled around the bottom and set, you know, but it doesn't happen.
Me.
It doesn't happen that often, and it's not that big a risk to run.
You know what they say about stuffing?
No.
Evaporation's a bitch.
No, I see. They don't say that. No one says that. Oh, my gosh. Okay. speaking of stuffing, the other best thing. All right. Stuffing's like, either the best thing on the table or it's 1A. There's one and 1A. The other, its counterpart would be the potatoes. And in this year, not only do we have mashed potatoes and how to do them ahead, and I think we'll get to that in the second half of this segment, but Chris, you've got this I don't know. I don't know if this is is this heresy, introducing a potato that's not mashed? But tell us about what's going on here.
God,
with the burnished potato nuggets.
Well, this is one of those moments, you know, where my wife, her one contribution to many meals over the years has just been roasted potatoes. And it was
I think you need to renegotiate that marital contract.
That's not, if you have one contribution,
read the
that's
fine
pretty
print,
good,
people.
You know?
But the amazing thing about it was kind of like, wait, what are you doing? You know, so here she is, she'd be blanching, you know, peeled russet potatoes, putting a roasting pan full of hot fat in the oven, heating it up, which just seems like, you know, terrifying. And
when you say
dangerous.
Hot fat, you mean like olive oil?
Like olive oil. She would probably, you know, she would use neutral oil or even like with like a touch of duck fat in it, mm-hmm. if like we mm-hmm. had it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I sort of dug deeper on, well, what are these? She would just be like, these are roasted potatoes where I come from. And
where is she from?
She's from England. So, but they're just that good. And, you know, in England, you go to a pub, you know, you get roast dinner. Roast meat, Yorkshire pudding, like kind of steamy vegetables, your crappy Brussels sprouts you mentioned, but you get these roast potatoes that have this like unbelievably crackling crisp exterior and then this fluffy kind of pillowy, you know, slightly steamy, you know, tender, creamy
interior. And you like russets for this?
Yes.
Because they have
you
that fluffiness.
That fluffiness.
Whereas for mashed potatoes, we always endorse Yukon Gold. They have that more buttery yellow quality.
Yeah.
So you're kind of par cooking them to cook them through, and then you're crisping them up in the super hot fat?
Barely.
I mean, like they're soft on the outside. And the trick of the whole thing is that you're boiling them in salted water, both to, you know, start to season them, but when you drain them, the outside is just sort of barely cooked. You drain them, return them to the pot, and then kind of rough them up
Ooh,
a little bit.
Yes.
You toss them around.
Scruffed.
You scruff them. And that kind of knocks like some of like the starch loose, and you get this kind of like pillowy kind of coating on the outside of them, such that when they are, you know, kind of, you know, when they're put into the hot fat in the oven, it's just like the depth. There's like it. It's almost as though you've like battered them.
Yeah. All those rough edges become crunchy.
I mean,
right.
this is
with
a
like
thing
a certain
that,
depth.
This is a thing that French fry manufacturers replicate in the French fry. They cut the French fries into the shapes, but then they toss the cut fries into potato starch.
Yeah, I don't like those.
But
versions.
This is the reason why, because
certain
hotels
have that.
It gets this like craggy, like crusty outer thing, but Chris is, you know, figured out how to deliver that through the natural beauty of the Idaho itself. So
right.
it's getting
like,
that like
I'm gonna trust
flowery
Chris.
Outside yeah. and then, but it's a real thing that you would that people are literally trying to engineer.
Yep.
This was the dish that during the tastings I was literally putting potato nuggets into my skirt and like folding, like, okay, well, that was great. And then going out of there with like an apron filled with these roasted potatoes.
They're delicious.
The
thing that I think is so good about them is they pair so well with gravy, you know. And when I was pitching this, you know, I said like clearly from the beginning,
pitching is not a football metaphor.
Sorry. Back when I, oh God.
Back when, I don't know.
Like training camp.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. All right. There we go. Back when you were trying out.
Yeah. Trying out.
Trying these out.
trying to make the roster. So yeah, I basically, you know, I just said, look, you know, if there's one thing the English have figured out, you know, it's that a crispy edged roast potato pairs a lot better with gravy. You know, that is like what roast dinner is all about, and or roast lunch. And for me, like, a mashed potato is a beautiful thing, but I don't necessarily need like soft, fatty gravy on top of like soft, fatty mashed potatoes. You know, there's just not like enough of a contrast there. But you put that luscious gravy on top of a crispy edge potato, and there's just, you know, there's magic.
I'm tempted to argue with you on that
you
one, but
did.
I'm like
I'm sure. Yeah,
I'm like, but
I know,
I'm like,
but I can tell you're thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm gonna think about that. All right, so Carla. Before we get to dessert,
yeah,
you specifically requested to discuss the dry rubbed turkey breast.
Yeah, I've never really had it for the white meat in general. Like, I don't think it's the best part of the turkey, and I know I'm not alone in that. It is where there's a very perfect ratio of skin to turkey meat, which I like about it. But generally, when we're roasting a whole bird, I'm like, dark meat or bust, you know? This is, if I had to crash Thanksgiving with extra turkey and just like randomly show up with like a boot full of turkey, it would be the breast. What I love about this recipe is that by separating the breast from the rest of the bird, but keeping the bone in, you are eliminating all of the problems of roasting whole turkeys, which is that the internal temperature of the leg and the internal temperature of the breast when they're optimized is not the same temperature.
Yeah.
So it's like giving yourself, really stacking the deck in your favor so that the breast is going to be really perfect. It is kind of got this like great expanse of real estate that's perfect for seasoning. And then you can just totally control the cooking and like
you can dial it in. You can dial it into the exact temperature you want.
And it's perfect. And then you have something that's really easy to carve. It's really easy to slice. It's great for sandwiches. It has a ton of flavor, and you get all the delicious brown skin.
Yeah. We call for 1 6-pound skin on, bone in. And that's the important thing, skin on, bone in, turkey breast, patted dry. Say it's about 8 servings, and you do a dry rub with coriander seeds, fennel seeds, black peppercorns, Diamond Crystal, or Morton's kosher salt, and light brown sugar. And you just rub it up.
And again, if you don't have those other dry spices that Adam just mentioned, the key things are the ratio of the salt and the sugar.
Yeah.
So like, it doesn't matter whatever dry spice you like. If your family likes coriander, fantastic. You want anise instead of fennel, I don't care. But make sure that your salt sugar ratio is right, and you follow the rest of the instructions, and you will have just perfect turkey meat.
Time for dessert.
Okay.
All right. I feel like maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like the hit single from the November issue is going to be the glazed and flaky apple tart. Yes? No? What do you think?
It's definitely a crowd pleaser.
That would probably be my favorite.
It's certainly the most Instagrammable of the desserts in this issue. Can you guys talk about it?
That can be one quality that is advantageous.
I haven't even had the thing. I'm just saying. It seems like people are into taking photos of this and making it. And so it's like a rectangular puff pastry sort of creation with halved glazed apples on top, like the whole thing, like 4x4 or whatever, with the little inside scooped out, and they get all burnished and tawny and glazed, and it's very pretty looking.
It's large format.
Yep.
It's apple, all the apple pie flavors. It's easier than pie.
It's a lot easier than pie.
Easier than pie.
Easier than pie.
Yeah, I mean, the trick there is just you're roasting those apple halves ahead of time. So you're kind of like, you're putting a little bit of bourbon, vanilla. I think there's a little bit of maybe like orange. Mm. So that roasts, so the apples then don't kind of sog out the crust later on when you go to like cook them on the crust. The flavors in that, there's just something like that, the fruitiness when you get when you combine like vanilla and apple and bourbon is just off the chain, and it's delicious. And I think it just, there is something like so just like pleasing and satisfying of like, you know, everybody is going to get like, you know, one half of an apple with like the square of pastry that kind of belongs, you know, to it. And underneath.
And I also like, so you've got this sort of this mattress of puff pastry, and then you scatter toasted sliced almonds on it before you lay in.
It's almonds and flour, like a very simple streusel, like almonds and flour mixed together, which both help absorb any residual moisture that's still coming off of the apple, but also the almonds get really toasty, crunchy in that second roasting time.
I love that.
We call and for, it's
we,
great.
We call for, if you would like a shortcut puff pastry recipe, I'm just going to go buy puff pastry. Is that okay?
I think that would be fine.
That's absolutely fine. Yeah, it would absolutely work fine.
Yeah, you do.
I'm actually not asking for your permission.
That's
I'm just
cool.
Telling
let
you
us know.
I'm
hey,
going to go
hey,
buy
Hey, Adam,
it.
Yeah. Gram it.
I'll gram it and let you
us
know.
Know. But the cool thing is the way you cut it into a rectangle, and then you trim off strips from all four sides of the rectangle, and you stack those to make a double height, and then those puff up and become the little like. The little border wall
yeah,
for your
like a little like sandbox.
I'm sorry I said border wall, everyone. It becomes a little you know, it's just holding everybody in.
Yeah.
yeah, so that is called the glazed and flaky apple tart. Finally, I did not have this one, but the cranberry Linzer tart. Do we like that? Do I like cranberries for dessert? I didn't know you could do that. Do
you
I?
Do. Yeah, we did the cranberry curd pie.
Hugely
you know, from
famous recipe.
Two or three
also
years ago.
Also on the Instagram.
Hugely yeah. famous.
Because it was like bright, like fuchsia color. Yeah.
I like that I like a tart, sour tart. It's like if you like a lemon curd dessert or you like something very, you know, punchy. I think it's a great addition. The Linzer dough intimidated me a little bit.
Did it?
It's a short crust.
It's a short crust. So you press in the bottom, you layer in your kind of cooked cranberry filling, and then you do this kind of like rough lattice on
right.
top.
Right. So you don't have to
dough.
Really go over, under,
yeah.
over,
nothing
under.
Nothing too crazy.
Nothing too crazy. Yeah. And I think she has you rolling it out between parchment so that it's, you know,
control
good
the
insurance.
Stickiness.
And,
I would say this. I think with desserts, like I don't like to have too many desserts. I don't want to have like, to put five slices of pie on my plate so I don't annoy someone. Like,
how about
why
three?
Why didn't you try my pie? I'm like, but I do like, if you're going to do like two desserts, they should be balanced. You should have like one sweet and rich and one maybe tart and acidic or whatever. You know, there should be like, if you're going to have pecan pie, then this is a nice rejoinder to that or something.
Totally.
Okay, guys. Thank you very much for talking new recipes for the Thanksgiving table. You can find all these recipes in the current issue of Bon Appetit on stands like, probably nowish. And
it's
then
the one
or,
with the turkey
on the
cover.
It's the turkey on the cover. Or you can find them at bonappetit.com. Or you can sign up for our newsletter at tinyletter.com/foodcast. And every week we will mail you all the recipes we talk about on the pod. Right now we're going to take a break and we will be back soon with listener questions.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, we are now back with listener questions. Lots of turkey questions. Eric Kim from Washington, D.C., and John Phillips from Clemens, North Carolina. They both inquired about the spatchcock turkey. John was considering grilling it. Eric was talking about watching your video, Carla, and asking about, you know, if he goes with a bigger size, how does that affect cooking time and doneness temperature and whatnot. You seem to be the spatchcock queen. Let's talk to us about it. And what should we know?
Does the world need to hear me talk about spatchcocking?
Yes,
maybe.
Anymore?
Yeah. Clearly.
Okay. So I heavily endorse spatchcocking your turkey if you're going to be roasting or grilling it. One of the things it does is sort of like equalize the thickness of the meat. So instead of this like giant cavity with the white meat sitting out perched up top, you've got everything opened up like a book, a lot of skin exposure, quick roasting time, no drying out.
And to be clear, just for anyone who doesn't know what spatchcock means, we're talking like butterflied. Like,
butterflied.
Yeah. And, so and you can ask your butcher to do this for you.
Definitely. Yeah. And even if you're going into a supermarket where you're taking a whole bird out of the cold case, just walk it over to the butcher case. You might have to wait a few minutes, hand it over the thing and be like, cut the backbone out for me. Keep the backbone. It's great for making your stock.
You might want to slip them 10 bucks or something.
Yep, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the holidays.
Maybe. Yeah,
it's the holidays. If you're going to grill, I would go the next step and I would do a split turkey. So in addition to taking out the backbone, cutting through the breastbone so that you have the two perfect halves. And the advantage of that is really just maneuverability on the grill. It's just easier to turn them over. They cook in 1 hour.
Yeah.
Really so fast.
And what size bird do you recommend?
We always call for 12 to 14.
It's manageable.
The roasting time is sort of the right amount to not get you into the dryness zone. The longer you spend exposed to the dry heat of the oven, the bigger chance you have of drying out. And obviously, a grill is a grill. You can only have so much real estate in the oven. Instead of scaling up, generally we call for
a second
bird. Mm, yes. Or in this case, look up the roasted turkey breast, and you can supplement like a whole bird with a breast and have extra meat to go around.
Question on the grill, say if you're doing charcoal, do you do sort of like a donut of coals around the bird so it's not directly underneath heat?
Ye old ring of fire?
Yes.
Yes. You can also bank to one side, so it all works. But I've made that barbecue spice brined grilled turkey more than once, and it's a great recipe.
I might have to do that this year. That or might do my confit dark meat, which
I love. The other thing that's great about grilling is you're outside away from people.
Outside, you're on your own, you're drinking your drink.
You're alone.
Oh, and I got a gas grill this year.
Yeah.
A fancy Lynx grill.
Yeah, you're like, bye, I'll be.
Lynx, you devil.
Chris, I'm going to hit you with this one because you are one of the recipe developer editors for our Healthy-ish website.
Sure.
So I like this one for you. Sarah Keel from Utah writes, I have a few family members who are lactose sensitive. Butter is okay, but cream and milk are not. Is there any way to make mashed potatoes that aren't the worst? It seems like almond, soy, coconut milk, etc. give the potatoes a weird taste. A weird sweet taste, she asks.
I mean, this is like maybe highly unorthodox, and I have to put my like healthy-ish sort of title on hold here for a second, but I would just probably make them extra buttery and frankly add a touch of water. I mean, there's so much
potato water, the starchy,
potato cooking
like
starchy, liquid.
Like that starchy kind of cooking water. Because I think if butter is fair play, just making them a little bit extra buttery. And frankly, to your point, Adam, you know, yes, go with like a Yukon Gold potato, you know, or even like a Redskin potato, something that's like ultra creamy.
I mean, if you really insist on having this sort of potato, like you can also do the thing where you do like this kind of the smash potato with olive oil, where you just have in a pot, you kind of smash them together and you got olive oil and a lot of like fresh mint or herbs in there. And it's just like, it's not the traditional mashed potatoes, but if you have to acknowledge you're not making traditional mashed potatoes,
totally.
Olive oil and butter together.
Oh, like
you don't need any milk. Olive oil and butter together, smash them up tender, add some herbs, salt, and you're good to go.
Yeah.
I love that.
I would definitely add the potato cooking liquid for
a little, loosen it up a little.
Yeah, just the liquid, but be careful not to over season that liquid because you're adding salt.
All right, Carla. Marissa Eskridge, not Melissa Etheridge. That was her name? What's her name with the big hit single back in the day?
Heck yeah. Mm-hmm.
Marissa Eskridge from Phoenix, Arizona. What is your favorite recipe for savory mashed sweet potatoes? I don't like mashed sweet potatoes, but I do like the notion of savory sweet potatoes, and we've done some of that. Can you talk us through a few that you like?
Yes and no. I think I like that there's a recipe we were just talking about, so someone else can chime in with the actual recipe name. I like those charred sweet potatoes with toom, which is not mash.
Explain
toom. Like, toom is a garlicky, it's basically a very garlicky aioli.
So that recipe on the site is called charred sweet potato with
toom.
T-O-U-M.
You roast the potatoes for tenderness and then you glaze them with honey and char them and serve them with this very garlicky, it's basically a garlic aioli.
It's garlic aioli
that doesn't
but with no
have egg.
So it's like this crazy emulsion.
It's like a miracle
and
sauce.
It's delicious. It's got a lot of fresh lemon juice. Another pairing that I really like for sweet potatoes is spice. So if you steam your sweet potatoes so they don't get all weird and leathery, but steam the sweet potatoes until they're totally tender and then mash them with butter and some chipotle chilies from the can, the chipotle liquid and chopped up chipotle chilies, you'll get a really nice smokiness with the sweet. You can add a little honey, the butter. That is delicious. You can roast it twice. Mm-hmm. Totally works out.
I also love the recipe that our buddy Andy Bergani did last year. Roasted sweet potatoes with chili, yogurt, and mint. Our friend Gabe T makes this all the time. And you sort of roast the sweet potatoes, then you tear them up, and then you roast them again so they get all crispy. And there's like this chili, the kind of limey, yogurty, minty sauce that goes with them. Really, really, really good.
Now, that's not mash. You specifically wanted mash. Yeah. But hopefully these are enough options.
I think you don't have to go the mash route. Like my feeling is also, like, if you have mashed potatoes at the table, why do you need mashed sweet potatoes? You should do something that introduces a different shape or texture or something.
I think that people who have grown up on very sweet, the mashed potato casserole with the marshmallows.
That's disgusting.
People are attached to the idea of having potato casserole.
Turn the page. Introduce something new. 2018 for... anyways, all right. We're moving on from the sweet potatoes, but both those ones, the charred sweet potatoes with thyme and the roasted sweet potatoes with chili, yogurt, and mint are highly recommended. And also in our newest issue, in the Bon Appetit issue, also in the November Bon Appetit, shingled sweet potatoes with harissa. We talk a lot about harissa. Explain that quickly.
I mean, the harissa is a Moroccan spice blend that has chilies and lots of dry spices in it. The recipes will vary from brand to brand, and so will the spice level. But it's just a great example of how sweet potatoes, because of their natural starchiness and their sugars and their kind of intense sweet flavor, can take a lot of other seasoning.
Yeah.
So harissa is like a great pairing for that.
And these you slice up into coins, and they get all glazed with the harissa, and you sort of layer them into a baking casserole, and they get chopped up pistachio on top.
Yep. Delicious. Lots of texture, lots of spice.
Also, crowd pleaser visually. Also good for the Instagram.
Great for the Instagram.
IG.
All right. This is a sort of an essential question. Chris, Jenna Bingham from San Francisco, what are your gravy tips? What happens if you don't get enough drippings from the gravy? Should I use turkey stock from the grocery store? People freak out about gravy. We have a recipe in our new issue that is completely do ahead and actually works.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's the umami gravy that Andy did. And that's the thing, you know, gravy is always this last minute thing. I feel like I've literally spent hours of my life waiting for Thanksgiving dinner to begin because my aunt is like literally making the gravy and it's not reduced enough and the seasoning's not right and everybody's like freaking out and getting, you know, hungry and cranky because they had Jack Daniels like all afternoon or whatever. But yeah, so this is a completely make ahead gravy that, you know, you're using the turkey neck and like other kind of like, you could use like other, you know, giblets and trim, you know, as well. But make the gravy ahead. You know, you can always use, you know, you can taste, you know, your drippings and, you know, if you want to deglaze them and add them in, you can absolutely do that, you know, strain them and add them at the last minute. But have your base, you know, make your turkey stock ahead. You can always buy store-bought, but if you can 100%. Make it yourself, this is the one day a year, you know, we would absolutely make the argument, do it from scratch. But making that base ahead and having your gravy done, it's a huge, huge, huge time saver.
And then
the
you're
end.
Like, if you get drippings, cool.
Yeah,
then it's like, it's gravy on the gravy.
It's gravy. It's all gravy. But yeah.
But if you don't need it. You have total control. You're making this on Tuesday.
Exactly. So this, search for it, bonapiti.com, or in the issue is called umami gravy, and that umami sort of moniker comes because we add a little soy sauce to it.
And a little bit of
shiitake
mushroom too, just quietly in there.
Yeah. All right. We have this next section of questions, Emma, titled Dealing with Other People. Deborah Backman, we will be guests this year and are attending a tea day dinner at the home of a relative who is a great cook and turns out a reliably delicious feast every year. But as a passionate cook myself, I feel like I'm missing out in the fun to not cook anything myself. Any ideas for what to bring, a fun little extra or bonus that will impress the family without looking like I'm trying to show up the host? Although, let's face it, I kind of am.
Can I field this one?
Yeah.
I have a two cents as well, but please, Carla, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Deborah, don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
What does that mean?
That means no one
knows what that actually means. But anyways, what's your point?
My point is, what you got a great thing going. Somebody else wants to host. She wants to do the whole thing. You're admitting that she's a great cook. You can host a dinner party any other day. Like, you don't have to go. Just be happy to be there. And if you want to contribute something, if you really genuinely want to contribute something to somebody else's evening and they're a great cook, ask her what she wants you to bring and then bring that.
Now, but you, the host is going to say bring a bottle of wine.
That's fine.
No, but you're, she wants
Deborah wants to make a splash.
Just
let get in the game.
Carla, you made your point. Chris, what do you have to say?
Deborah, you know, I have to say in this kind of situation, bring like a show-stopping pie or dessert. That way, you know, if you think you're going to bring some side dish and then like, you know, get real estate, you know, from the host to like heat it up and like, oh, but can I borrow a platter or some dish, you know, like they are going to hate you. But if you just show up with a pie that looks like, you know, absolute dynamite. Yeah,
you know, but what if you bring a pecan pie and the host already made a pecan pie?
I feel like you can get intel ahead of time.
Make it onto the sideboard at my
house. But you just bring it out, and once people see it, they're going to want to eat it, Carla.
What about this? What about if you just bring some like nice like spiced nuts for cocktail hour? Kind of warm, you know, still warm with all the like the rosemary and chilies and stuff. And you set
do
those
that.
Out.
You could also
a nice
bring
a little thing. And if the host can like save them for later,
it's kind of a horse you can put gift out or something. Yeah.
You could also bring some really nice chocolates that are not going
to
upstage.
No, but she wants to
desserts.
Make something. She wants something homemade to bring because
I think Deborah should go for it.
I think Deborah should host a Christmas party.
Deborah, you are not getting an invitation to the Lolly household this year. Sorry, dude. All right, now we're going to move on to the general prep timing / stressing section. Michaela Tierney? I'm not sure how you pronounce your name, Michaela, but I hope that was close enough. I'm making Thanksgiving for my future in-laws this year, and it's my first time ever cooking a turkey or preparing a full Thanksgiving meal. No pressure. I'm already planning ahead on recipes and timing. Turkey brines, day ahead, prep sides. Love the parens, Michaela. You should come work at Bon Appetit. But I know things will inevitably end up super hectic and stressful as hell on the day of.
True.
What's your go-to move to keep your cool in the kitchen as hostess while also balancing all of the cooking? So can we maybe go through like sort of tips, guys, for like, again, like how do you maintain your sanity? How do you not like kill your spouse? How do you like remember to shower? All those things in terms of the day of and executing the meal.
I would say just a global rule, do fewer dishes. I think, especially if you're hosting for the first time and you're like, oh, every Thanksgiving you ever had, you're going to add up all of those dishes and expect that you should serve all of them. Don't. You can get away with making 6 things, 5 of which can be made ahead of time. You need to simplify, fewer dishes, an abundant amount of food. You will be in great shape. Also, don't be afraid to delegate. So if you have a mother-in-law who's very excited to come and knows that you haven't hosted before, you know, give her a job. Like outsource.
Danielle Sanders from Scottsdale, Arizona, had a similar sentiment. She says, I always joke that it's not Thanksgiving unless I'm crying on the kitchen floor at some point. Ha ha. And talk about doing stuff ahead. We have in terms of doing stuff ahead, we talked about the do ahead gravy we have in the current issue. We also talked about do ahead mashed potatoes and also reheating those gently and then adding some milk or cream as you reheat, because as the potatoes stand or sit or cool, they will tighten up. Yep. But you can do those ahead as well. I'm a big proponent of, I love the to-do list, literally taping a list to the side of your fridge with everything you have to do that day and just crossing them out with a Sharpie as you go, because you're always going to forget something.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I forgot to go to the store to buy bottled fancy fizzy water for the table. There's going to be something. Or, forgot about ice. Just seeing that visually in front of you, I love to do. That really helps me sort of mentally sort of conquer the day. Chris, what about you in terms of organizational techniques?
Yeah, I think it's having that game plan. And I think to your point, Carla, it's setting reasonable expectations. And I think like 36-hour Thanksgiving that we did a couple years ago that Claire did was just really smart in terms of making really smart choices about dish selection.
Yeah.
And not everything has to be like a massive statement, you know, like stuffing can become a massive project. Like Claire's from that year, you know, it was a little bit more like a savory bread pudding. Everybody's
going to
love it. You know, it's like, and if you're freaked out by pie, you know, the apple pan dowdy she made, you know, a couple years ago, it's so easy. It's like store-bought puff pastry and then like beautiful kind of glazy, delicious, like apple, you know, with like cinnamon and butter and all kinds going on. And people are going to love it.
People have a hard time enjoying themselves if they know that you're a wreck,
freaking out,
you know,
they're just like grimace face emoji. They're like, "Ugh, God, are you
you're
okay?"
You're hosting, you're feeding people. That goes a really long way.
Mike Caron, quote unquote, first time caller, long time listener. Thanks for that joke, Mike. And Daniel Dunn of Frederick, Maryland. They have a similar question. Daniel writes, my boyfriend and I are attending Thanksgiving at his mom's house in Bethesda, Maryland. Shout out Bethesda, about an hour away. She's extremely busy, has us to help cook, yada, yada. My question is, what would be the best foods that we could prepare ahead of time and reheat so we won't come in and destroy the kitchen for 12 hours? And again, it seems like there are certain dishes, if someone asks you to bring something, certain things travel well. Certain things don't. What do you like to actually bring to someone's house if you have to bring something?
I actually made a list when I read this question of like what can you take away from the Thanksgiving menu and still have it feel like a Thanksgiving dinner? And almost everything can be made ahead with the exception of the turkey. Although I did examine that, like if you do a braised,
we're not going there, you made those braised legs.
You could totally
you just bring the crouzet or stout pot, you could actually make ahead turkey
or the turkey could be the only thing that you put really that you need to like cook when you from raw, but we figured out how to do potatoes, gravy, pie, a salad dressing.
Yeah, I would say this. I would say what we've also talked about in terms of how much you are sort of insinuating yourself into the cooking process. Like sometimes, like you don't want it to ask someone for real estate on the stove or in the oven. What you talked about before, like the broccoli Caesar, or we have that kale Brussels salad that we love on Bon Appetit. It's all shaved with the almonds and stuff. Where you can have it in a bag. You can have your dressing in a little jar. You can even bring a salad bowl if you want.
Right.
And you're like, all right, just let me know when to toss it, and I'll toss it. Like that sort of stuff is great. The pie, the things that don't require heating or whatnot is really nice.
Yeah. And like you said, not showing up at 1 p.m. because you need to do all this stuff when you're at that location.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, we have some questions about leftovers from Jody Silberstein in Red Bank, New Jersey, and Lorcan Shannon, originally from Ireland, who now lives in New York City. They want to know about leftovers. But you know what, guys? We're not going to answer your leftover questions because we're having a special bonus podcast on Friday devoted exclusively to leftovers. Carla, me, and our friend Gabe T.
True story.
Talking about the best things to do with your Thanksgiving leftovers. So guys, tune in everyone on Friday, 2 days after this pod, and check it out. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carla, as always.
Always.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.